When we are dating, we are oftentimes constantly thinking about what the other person is thinking of us rather than what we actually think about them.
Welcome back, everyone, to our next episode with Heal Your Roots podcast. I am your co-host, Daniela Galdi, and I am the founder of Vivesta Agency, producer with Heal Your Roots Wellness for this podcast, as well as a health and wellness professional.
Hi, everybody. I'm Kira Yakubov, lead therapist and founder of Heal Your Roots Wellness. Every episode, we'll be talking to a mental health professional and getting to know them a little bit more as human beings and what they do in the field.
And today we have Lior Gale here with us as our guest. Lior is a licensed marriage and family therapist and the owner of The Therapy Gale, a group practice located in Pennsylvania. She enjoys creating relatable therapy-related videos on both TikTok and Instagram, and works towards destigmatizing mental health. She also published a journal called Empower Your Mind, which is a 12-week prompted journal that we will definitely be talking about today. And she shares with us that her mission is to prove that therapy can be fun along with being serious and challenging. And therapy can be for anyone that wants an objective perspective and is looking to grow. So welcome, Lior. It's so great to have you.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh my gosh, of course. Okay, so we're just going to dive right in. And so that was a beautiful bio, and I can't wait to hear more on everything that you do. I know a little bit later we'll get into also some dating talk as well, but if you could just tell us a little bit more about yourself so that our listeners can really get to know you.
Yeah, absolutely. So hi, everyone. I'm Lior. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. I am currently living locally in Philadelphia. I'm hoping to make a move to New Jersey soon, but as we all know, the housing market is crazy. But I opened up my own practice back in June, and I have an employee, and it's growing slowly, but it's growing because I've noticed such a need for therapy. And I absolutely love this field. I'm so happy to be in it, and I'm just happy to be here on this podcast.
Oh, thanks, Lior. And congratulations on you opening your practice and expanding. I know that's a very big deal and not an easy thing to do. So congrats on that. That's huge.
Thank you. Thank you. And I was very lucky to have Kira by my side throughout the whole process. And I'm sure we will talk about how you and I met, which is like the most crazy experience ever, the connections that we had. But it's so important to have connections and support when taking a big leap like that.
Absolutely. So we'll definitely get into that a little bit later. But I do always love to start off and ask our guests, what got you into the field? Like, is this something you've always wanted to do, or did you transition into therapy? Kind of share with us a little bit of your backstory.
You know, I love this question every single time somebody asks me this, because it was completely unconventional how I got into this field. Meaning, when I say it fell in my lap, it literally fell in my lap. And I know that that's not the answer that most people want to hear, because a lot of people are like, I thought of this ever since I was 2 years old, and I knew I wanted, and that wasn't me. I didn't know that this was for me until I was 25 years old. So I went to school for 4 years. I got a communications degree. I worked for a little bit and realized this sucks. Like, this is not for me. Not that it sucks for everybody else, but for me, I realized that I wasn't good at it. I didn't find joy in it. So I quit my job. I moved back home with my parents. This all happened, by the way, within a day. I was just like, I don't want to do this anymore. And I quit my job. This is not a sign out there for everybody to just do that, because I was young. I had support. I was able to move in with my parents. I didn't have a lot of bills, so I was able to do that. And I went back to school, with the idea of becoming an occupational therapist. And I took bio, anatomy, stat. Like, I did all of those classes that I have never taken in undergrad, that's for sure. and I loved it. I took more psychology classes as well, because that's one of the prerequisites for our OT. And I applied and it was really, really hard to get in, to the point where I was like, I don't even know if I really want to do this. So one day I was like, oh, this is a cool program. And it was Jefferson's Marriage and Family Therapy program. And they reached out to me. I reached out back to them. I interviewed and I got in. And that is how I became a therapist. And every time I tell the story, everyone's like, what? You just decided one day? And I was like, yeah. And it was the best decision I've ever made in my entire life.
That's amazing. Well, they say the things that are meant for us do not that the process is always easy, but it comes to us easily. And it just seems right. And you recognize it, and there's no questioning usually behind it. It's just like, yeah, this is what it is. So I love hearing that. That was what it seems like it felt like for you, along with the process of, wait, you know, am I going to go here? What program can I get into? What's going to be the best, you know? So what was your experience like at Jefferson and then following graduation?
Yeah, I think one small thing that I want to say is, it wasn't that I just all of a sudden, like, I've never thought of this before, and then I became a therapist. I always knew I wanted to help people, but I never thought that I could sit in front of someone and hear them talk about really hard, difficult things, because I would feel so upset about it. And so I always put being a therapist to the side, because I was like, I can't do that. I'm not emotionally equipped to do that. Who am I to help somebody with that? And so when I started doing it, it was such an amazing experience to say, like, I don't need to be perfect in order to be able to do this. I just need to know what I'm doing. I need to obviously get the training for it. And I did love my program at Jefferson. We had amazing, amazing, amazing practicum. We worked with women in shelters. We worked with so many different types of people. And because I was in Philadelphia, I got to work with just everybody and everything. And it was in all different, you know, capacities. And especially as a marriage and family therapist, I needed to get, you know, a certain amount of hours of systemic experience, meaning couples and families. And I realized, like, wow, this is such incredible work, and something that obviously everybody can benefit from it. But I really loved my experience in grad school. It was definitely a great, great time for me.
I love that. And I love your original story of that wasn't even on the radar really in the beginning. Right. That was like very similar for me. I went to school for accounting. Like, I was going to be, my idea was I'm going to be a CPA. And it's not because I had like this desire or love for math, right? It was my parents were like, it was my junior of high school. And I was like, Dad, I don't know what I want to be. And he's like, well, Eastern European background. Well, you know, accounting is a stable job for a woman, and you're like good at math, so just do that. And I was like, all right, cool. And then I had my internship at a tax firm. And 1 week later, I came home crying and said, I hate my job. I hate all of this. And then slowly started to shift to psychology. And so I'm curious, because Lior, I know you're also an immigrant and you have Eastern European roots. How did your parents take that when you told them you wanted to be a therapist?
Oh my gosh, I remember. So first of all, I have a photographic memory, which I only found out recently when my clients are like, how do you remember what I did or wore or said in that session? I'm like, I think something's wrong with me. I don't know why. So nothing's wrong with me. I think I just have a photographic memory. So I remember when I didn't tell my parents about it until after my interview. And I remember if it was right after I even got accepted or it was just after the interview, but I remember walking to their bedroom. It was like 10 p.m. And this is at the time I was living with them because I had moved back. And I was waitressing and I was also nannying at the time. And I was like, I'm going to be a therapist now. So I'm starting grad school. Google. So my parents were like, oh, what? But then, so as Kira, as you just said, Eastern European, and my dad is Israeli. My dad doesn't have a lot of opinions, as my mom, of course, but my mom was like, what? And I was like, but it's at Jefferson. And she's like, oh.
That made the difference.
That's a very good school. It's a good school for you. My mom's acting is not that Russian.
Mine is.
I bet. Oh, I have a perfected accent. It's like my
same
other the part of me. But my mom was like, okay, well, I guess it's Jefferson, so it must be some great program. And they were very skeptical. They were definitely very skeptical, but they were like, you're going to pay for it. Like, we're not paying for your school. And I was like, fair. And I did it. And I think they took me seriously because I took out a lot of loans for that program. But they were like, you must be very serious about this. And I was like, yeah, I really am. And now they're like, holy crap. We can't believe we even doubted for a second that this would be your calling.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Do you see it kind of opening their world too in terms of mental health and seeking professional help?
Yes and no. I think it's still foreign.
Like that mixed review. Yep.
Yeah. But they're very, very supportive of me and what I do. I think a lot of the times my parents are more impressed by my social media presence than anything. And like, if I do like a brand deal or something, they're like, our daughter is so incredible because they paid her to do video and it's amazing. And I'm like, okay, but what about my master's? What about on a daily basis?
No, you run business. This is good.
Yeah, exactly. No, but they, all of, obviously all jokes aside, they are very proud and they're so happy that I've just settled down with something that fits me, and they're not worried about it.
I can definitely see your passion coming through, and I love that you, so Kira mentioned a little bit about her accent as well. You both have that you can connect on, because Kira's also very good at that. But you know, how else did you two connect? How did you become friends?
Wow. So Kira, oh my gosh, this is the best story.
So funny.
So how I mentioned I nannied, the mom that I nannied for was amazing. She was the sweetest person in the world, and she knew I was, you know, starting off as a therapist, and I eventually wanted to go into private practice, but I didn't know who to talk to. And she was like, well, I have this one friend who knows someone that, like, maybe you can ask her for coffee and you guys can meet up. And Kira, is it okay if I finish the story? I love telling.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. I'll tell you my take on it. It was funny.
I know. Yeah. I wonder what your take is. So I reached out to Kira, and she was so sweet, so amazing. We met up at Starbucks and we're talking, we're like really getting along and connecting and yada, yada. And I remember like, oh my God, let me add you on Facebook. And I go on Facebook and I was like, wait, we have this mutual friend. And Kira was like, oh, who is it? And I was like, can I say the name?
Yeah,
can I say the
name? Yeah, absolutely.
I was like, Aran, I know Aran. And she was like, that's my fiance. How do you know him? And I was like, no.
I was like, here we go. No, I'm kidding.
I was like, no, Aran's parents were best friends with my parents growing up, and I was best friends with his sister growing up. And I was like, wait, you're dating him? That's so crazy. So we have this like crazy connection where I was like, I cannot believe you're about to get married to Aran, who was like basically a part of my entire childhood leading up to until I think he went to college. And then, you know, people go apart, but it was crazy.
Yeah, that was so funny. I remember I walked in and I sat down, you were looking at me and you were like, you look so familiar. I feel like we've met before. And I was like, no, I'm really good with faces. I've never seen you or met you before. I would know. And you're like, okay. And then that's when it came up. You're like, I knew I saw your face somewhere. And it was on Facebook from Aran's page. So yeah, that's been funny. But we've connected and we've stayed in touch since then. just, I mean, we're colleagues in the field, right? And we were killing it. I mean, you're doing a phenomenal job. And like, I love watching your growth from the beginning process to now, because it's been incredible. And like, you hustle and you've been killing it. And I've like, I saw your journal. I was like, that's inspiration. Like, I want to start a journal and like do that too. So, I mean, I think it's everything you've been doing is really fabulous. And I'm so proud of you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I feel like when, if anybody ever doubts me at any point in my life, I have this like weird thing where I'm like, well, you know what? I guess I'm going to have to prove you wrong. So I'll do everything I can to do that.
I am raising my hand to that because I feel that. I feel that I'm like, oh, you just said no, darn. Now I'm going to have to do it. Okay. Here we go.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that's probably something I need to work on.
But not our stuff done.
There you go.
Can you tell us more about the journal?
Yeah. So the reason behind the journal, or the motivation behind the journal, is I would have session after session with my clients just either struggling to, you know, process more of what we talk about in therapy during the week, or sometimes even think about topics to talk about, or say like, I'm good, but then we find that there's a lot of things below the surface. And so I thought, you know, instead of me just telling somebody, journal at night, whatever comes up, comes up, because a lot of people really do struggle with that. I was like, what if I prompted people? What if I created a journal that not only allows you to include gratitude, include, you know, how you self-care, which the journal also explains and has inside of it. But also I divided each week to a different theme. And then within each week, every day of the week, there is a different journal prompt that you get to answer and sort of process and think about what it means to you. And it was all thanks to my clients that I was like, this is, there's clearly a need for it, and people can do this and just sort of have it nearby or have it on their nightstand and check in with it. And yeah, that's sort of what prompted it.
That's awesome. I love that. And even thinking about journaling, right? I'm sure you obviously now tell your clients and have before about journaling. And I tell my clients all the time how powerful journaling is. And I think the toughest part of starting for me here, all my clients, is I don't know what to write about, or I don't even know where to start, or how do I know how to reflect deeper, right? Like, how do I know how to prompt myself to process even further to get to some of those root causes, or just like bring that awareness about what's going on for you? So I love that you use the practical work that you're in, found a need, and was like, oh, let me help people address this. That's awesome.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, it's been good too. My clients got it and they've enjoyed it. 12 weeks and that's it.
I love that. I applaud you for that too, because you really put a lot of thought behind it and intention. And I love the parts about just taking people into like a deeper self-awareness with that reflection that they can do with that. So that's amazing. And we'll make sure, for anyone listening, we'll make sure we have the link in the show notes as well, so they can check it out too. But let's keep going with this. I mean, Kira, I feel like you two colleagues, friends, but like, any dying questions that you really want to ask Lior?
Well, I know that, you know, your training's marriage and family therapy, but who do you enjoy working with the best, or what do you feel like your specialty or niche is that you are just like, these are my people, like, these are my aligned clients, this is what I want to focus on?
Yeah, I'm really glad you're asking me this question, because a lot of times people think that marriage and family therapists only work with couples and families. And that's really, really not the case. I think most of my client load is actually individuals. The thing that sets us apart, and I'll go into my niche. but I think that MFTs have this unique perspective that is more systemic, as viewing the individual more as a part of their system rather than just the individual. And so whenever I'm working with somebody, I definitely take that lens of, well, what made you who you are today? What has molded you? What has kept you grounded or made you feel about life, you know? And so I would say my connection with like couples work and individual work is I really, really enjoy working with individuals around attachments, around dating, just as them as the individual in the relationship. I always invite their partner in if I'm working with an individual and they're having relationship issues. So I have that training to be able to do that. And I really, really enjoy that. I enjoy transitions, like from college to being a young adult in the workforce, especially because I knew I had such a hard time with it and I switched around and stuff. So I really love, you know, working with teenagers, young adults, and dating transitions.
And do you have a favorite, like, approach or method or philosophy behind this?
Yeah. So I think that with each client, there's going to be a different approach. So if I approach somebody with an emotion-focused philosophy, which is more emotionally based, I know that, you know, they vibe with that, meaning they might struggle with emotions. They might need more of that feelings wheel. If anybody's curious what that is, just Google it. It's really great. I love doing that. But if somebody is like, I know how I'm feeling, like you don't have to explain primary and secondary emotions to me. I know. I read about it. I know. Okay. We might need to go, you know, a little bit different of a route. So it's usually very different in terms of the clients that I'm working with, but what I always bring to the table is relatability, meaning I'm not judgmental. Honestly, I've probably done half of this stuff myself, so I can be. And I like to meet clients where they're at, meaning, am I going to challenge you 100%? 100%? But I'm not going to push you. So that's my philosophy of like, I'm going to challenge you, but I'm not going to push you, because if I push you too hard, you're out of here and then nobody wins. So I like to always check in with my clients, and just kind of, yeah, just feel them out, feel their vibe and what really they're coming in for.
I love that. We have such a similar approach and background. And of course, like the training with being a marriage and family therapist is that relationships are so crucial to our growth and the fulfillment of our life. And I think sometimes it's hard because, especially with dating, right? There's so many myths and like cliches, like you have to be whole, you have to love yourself before you can date somebody else. And to degrees, right? Like there's a lot of different approaches to take with dating, and having relationships be a huge part of the work that we do in those attachments. What do you feel like is a pretty common issue that comes up for your clients around dating?
Oh, I feel like it's always about the games. Everybody feels like everybody plays games. And the more I think about it, the more I wonder if it's games or if it's boundaries or if it's an avoidant attachment versus a anxious attachment. I'm always noticing everybody being annoyed by games, but also playing the games themselves. And I don't have, I wish I had like a lens to look at everybody and how everybody is, but I obviously don't have that. But I'm very intrigued by that because I hear it over and over and over again. They didn't text me back, or I'm not doing this, or they just ghosted me, or, you know, they reappeared and da da da. And I'm like, well, I feel like there's a different reason for each person, but it happens a lot. And I think if I could take a wild clinical guess, I think the dating apps and the availability of finding people in a snap and having somebody else there, that might play a part of, well, I don't need to commit because there are so many other fish in the sea.
Y'all, I am over here taking notes. Trying to hold in my laughter, so I'll share with everyone. Kira is, here knows all of this, but I'm actually, I came into this episode a little nervous because I came from a relationship of 12 years and have been single for 6 months now. And finally feel like, okay, I could hang out with someone. We won't go for calling it a date yet, but I could hang out with someone. And so, you know, when I hear you say all these things, I'm over here nodding my head like, yep, I don't want to play the games, but here I am like, oh, let me post this because maybe that'll get a response. Or, you know, I haven't tried the apps yet, but it's very hard to not internalize everything from somebody else's behavior. Right? Because I feel like this is like a very vulnerable time. So do either of you have any thoughts on that? On, it, you know, is it even healthy to maybe internalize it? I mean, I'm questioning everything I do and I try to let go and then I find myself doing it again. So, you know, what do you two think on that?
I think my favorite response to that question is when we are dating, we are oftentimes constantly thinking about what the other person is thinking of us rather than what we actually think about them. So there is a phenomenon, of course, where we want to be liked by others. We want to be, you know, whether it's chased or favored or wanted, that we lose sight of, do I even want them? And going into these situations, whether it's a date or whether it's the apps or whether it's talking to someone, whatever, going into it, like, well, how does this person actually make me feel? Because if they're making me feel like I have to, like, go upside down, backwards, through loops, just to talk to them or get their attention, maybe they're not the right person for me. So always checking in with yourself. Yeah, I understand the internalization of it, of course. But if it's a person that constantly makes you second guess yourself or think some sort of way, maybe it's not you, right? And maybe it's not them. It's just not a match.
I love that, Lior. And Danielle, thank you for being vulnerable and sharing that. I think that's a really big deal. So I appreciate that. And I think that's going to be helpful for the listeners also to connect and relate. I remember when I was dating, and a piece of advice that I heard from somebody that really helped is I also had like a very anxious attachment. I would be in my head, like, what are they thinking? What does this text mean? Like interpreting everything down to the T with the final goal of, do they like me? Right. And if they don't, what does that say about me? And this piece of advice I heard is if you just meet someone, let's say it's a first date, first few dates, and you know, they end things with you and you feel rejected. They didn't really reject all of you. They don't even know you well enough to know anything about you. They just rejected the match, and that's okay. That doesn't mean anything about your worth, your self-esteem, what you can offer. It's just the misalignment, and that's okay. And that means that they're a misalignment for you too. But I think a lot of dating is going to be rejection because we only need to find one or two, depending on your relationship structure, but not everyone's going to be a match, and we don't have to have everyone like us. So I don't know if that was helpful advice on that question for you.
It was. My sarcastic response in my head was, we don't?
Well, that's valid. That's sort of why I think Kira and I both touched on it is, and I mean, Kira, I can't speak for you, of course, but I want to be liked by everyone. But then I remember if I do that, that means I'm not authentic. Mm-hmm. You can't possibly blend in with everybody in this world. Possible.
I love that. Thank you both for sharing those insights. I don't want this to turn into like dating 101 for me, but let's turn it into dating 101 for everybody else. What are some things that you like to approach or some healthy management tools that both of you can share for people in transition or, you know, specifically with like any type of relationships?
I think Kira sort of spoke to this a little bit before, but the idea that you need to be fully healed in order to be in another relationship, or I always hear these like really random timelines of, if you dated for 1 year, then you need to be single for 1 month. If it was 6 years, then it's 6 months. And if it's, and I'm like, where, who made this up? Because I'd like to meet them and I don't know, talk to them, because to me, you don't need to be fully 100% healed, because that's impossible. So you will be single forever if that is the motto that, you know, you decide to take, because we as human beings heal in the context of others. And so if we're waiting and waiting and waiting, and there's this missing piece for us, maybe that can be accomplished through another's secure attachment, right? Carrie, I know you mentioned an anxious attachment. 100% I relate to that. That's why my partner is securely attached, and he helped me.
It wasn't same.
His choice. It wasn't his choice, but we met, we fell in love, and I got to learn what it's like to feel secure and comfortable with him. Was I 100% healed when I met, healed, quote unquote, when I met him? No. Am I still? No. But I know that I feel comfortable and safe and secure in this relationship. And things will still come up, and fights will happen or arguments, but I know that no matter what, I can always rely on this person. So in terms of dating and starting to date, recognizing, like I said before, how this person makes me feel and what do they bring to me? And yeah, sure, what do I bring to them? But again, we're thinking of ourselves. We need to think of ourselves first of, do I feel comfortable with this person?
I totally agree. And I love going into more of that healing part or feeling ready to be in a relationship, because there will be a lot of work we have to do internally and individually, right? Like there's this duality, like us in relationships and us on our own and independent, and finding a balance between those two is super important in life in general, but especially in romantic relationships. And so we might feel like we're in a good place. Like, you know what, like, I get where some of my shit's coming from. I've worked on a lot of things. I feel good. I feel ready to date. And then you meet somebody who might be great for you, and that might be a successful relationship down the line. But in the beginning, it's going to trigger all your stuff, and that's okay. And so that's kind of like what you're saying is, we heal within relationships too. There's no amount of work you can do prior that's going to prepare you for the work that has to happen within the relationship. And that person is going to be coming in with their own stuff and their own triggers, right? So we meet each other where we're at, and we work through that phase together. And something I love to work on with my individual clients who are like, you know what, I'm ready to date, or they're dating, is creating a morals and values list for themselves, about themselves, not necessarily about the person they're looking for, which is helpful down the line sometimes, but more importantly, like, what are your values? Like, what's important in your life that you need, that you just know you need, that is like a non-negotiable, that you know is going to be fulfilling for you, right? It's like, for example, I really need mental stimulation and I need a lot of physical touch. And I knew, like, if those two things are missing, no matter how attracted I was, no matter how, like, whatever it is on paper, they look great, it's not going to be a good fit for me, because down the line, it's just not going to be fulfilling. So it's kind of like knowing some of these things about yourself ahead of time, so that when you are dating, it's like, does this match with who I am, and not just like the chemistry in the moment?
I think that that sort of also speaks to the games, right? Of, am I being a little hard to get and a little cheeky, or am I completely letting go of all my morals and values in order to match up with that person? Right? Like, oh, I don't need a text back, but really you do need somebody to check in with you. You need somebody to check in with you. And that's okay. I'm sure there are other people out there that probably feel the same way.
And that goes into, I mean, at least for us, I know, like, the anxious attachment, secure attachment, avoidant, right? I think that a very common dynamic that happens is the avoidant. Someone who has an avoidant attachment is dating someone who has an anxious attachment. Because the beliefs we have about ourselves and relationships, we live out and confirm them subconsciously, right? So, I mean, if we grew up with the narrative that I have to earn love, and I have to really put in a lot of work to feel worthy will attract somebody who is expecting someone else to do a lot of the work in the relationship and be chaste. And that confirms that belief over and over again. But guess what? It also confirms the belief that when someone comes too close, I need to pull away and I have to chase, 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 right? Like we just keep getting stuck in this cycle. Yeah. So I think for you, Lior, what do you do when you see this kind of in your clients, whether it's in couples work, which is a lot more interesting, or in individual work when you just have the one person with you?
Yeah. So I think the clinical term to this is the intimacy dance of the pursuer and the distancer. And I believe that also comes from emotionally focused couples therapy. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely something that I oftentimes see. And I think what is a great tool or coping skill for this is to, first of all, if you're in therapy, for the therapist to call it out, right? Like, hey, I'm noticing this. What, please explain to me why this is, you know, what's causing this to happen, where this is coming from. And typically when we understand what has caused our attachment or what is allowing us to lean in more towards whether being anxious, avoidant, insecure, you know, whatever, disorganized, we can understand how to heal it. And so for me, it's number one, baseline foundation is, like I said before, what has made you who you are today? And attachment styles are oftentimes created in childhood, but they're not necessarily just in a broken attachment or unhealed attachment with the caregiver, but rather you can have a secure attachment with your friends and an anxious attachment with a partner and an avoidant attachment with parents. It's what has affected you. How were you morphed and how people in your life reacted to you growing up? That is my number one technique to understanding and healing attachment wounds, especially in couples, if I'm doing couples therapy, and helping the other person understand, each other and sort of just literally drawing it out and explaining this is what's happening. But I don't know, Kira, if you have a different method, I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty spot on, right? Like we take a lot of time to explore, you know, those beginning relationships and attachments. And I love that you mentioned your attachment is, first of all, it's not stagnant. It's not something that's like stuck on you for the rest of your life. And it looks different within different relationships, right? So I had a lot of secure attachments with my friendships. I could trust that they'll show up for me. I could trust to be myself and share my emotions, right? Like if I texted them a lot, they knew, like I didn't feel like I'm being needy because they needed the same amount of attention as I did. Or if they didn't, we just knew and there wasn't a judgment, right? But when you're starting to date, that attachment can look really different. So I think understanding what the emotions are that are coming up for you, what are the beliefs that you have around yourself and other people, and trying to kind of challenge those and poke at the flaws in the thinking, right? Because these are narratives that have just been conditioned, but they don't have to necessarily be true. And accepting that, like, if you have these particular amounts of needs, like, that's okay. It might seem needy to someone who, A, doesn't have the same amount of needs in that capacity, or they're just not willing to provide it, and that's okay, but it doesn't mean that you're needy. Just means your needs are going unmet.
Exactly.
I think that's important differentiation.
Right. You're not needy. You just have needs. Period.
I love that. And I feel like we need to put that out into the world. You're not needy. You have needs. And it's a very real thing, right? It's a real thing. Not anything we should feel shame or guilt for. And I believe, I really do feel you both did a great job, like through explaining the attachment styles and the inference with using your examples. But just to briefly recap for the listeners, if one of you could share maybe an example, maybe let's use texting since it's so common, right? Brief examples as to, you know, the different styles of attachments you mentioned and what that looks like.
So if we're even using the example of texting, right? Let's say you just went on a first date. It went great. Okay. And now the texting, the waiting, the, all that stuff begins, right? The contact between the people. So I think if you happen to resonate with an anxious attachment style, you're going to be preoccupied, like almost hyper fixated on, Are they going to text me? Should I text them? If I am going to text them, how long should I wait? Is it going to come off too forward? How should I say this? I'm going to text all my friends and ask them what I should say. And then let's say you get a text back or it's been an hour. You might be freaking out like, okay, I said the wrong thing. What are they going to say? Maybe they don't like me. It's really just like this preoccupation. It's really this hyperfixation on the other person and what they're thinking about and how that is going to result in if they care about me or not, right? It's like this external view of what the other person is looking for and needing and feeling versus our own self. Whereas let's say you might resonate with an avoidant attachment style in dating, it might look like, I can go all day. Yeah, that person was really cool. I really enjoyed their energy, but like, I don't need to talk to them today. I'm going to do my own thing. I'm going to, you know, focus on my work, hang out with my friends. Oh yeah, they popped into my head. Let me shoot them a text and say, hey. And they might start texting you back immediately. Like you just said, hey, and they text you back like, hey, what's going on? When do you want to hang out again? You might feel like, oh, that's like a little much. Maybe they're kind of clingy. Maybe I should take a step back. But I did like them. But let me just take a step back to like let them know to chill. And if you have a secure attachment, you're probably not thinking of any of those things. You're like, I really enjoyed my time with them yesterday. I want to let them know I had fun. I'm going to see when they're free again. And I text them and I go on about my business. And then when they reach back out to me, it's like, awesome, we're on the same page. Let's meet up. Or they might not be. And like, that kind of sucks. All right. On to the next. So I don't know, Lior, if you kind of vibe with that or if there's like a different example you have around that.
No, I fully agree with everything that you just said. And I think what's happening with either anxious or avoidant attachment is there's a lot of unspoken things that we assume the other person should know. Meaning, I'm not going to, you know, from the avoidance standpoint of, I'm not going to respond so that they know to chill. Well, I'm not saying that. I'm doing that with my actions. And instead of that being conveyed to the person that is anxiously attached of, well, okay, maybe we need to like chill a little bit. They're like, they hate me. I have to make them love me now. So I'm going to pursue them more. And it's not on purpose. And it's not, you know, and look, I'm speaking from an anxious perspective because I was definitely that. It's not out of malice. And that's a thing, both parties, it's not out of malintent. It is just this like non-communicative communication that does not work. It just doesn't. We have to communicate always.
Wow, so interesting. So we're aiming for secure attachment.
So secure attachment can be built, right? Like I said earlier, it's not something that's stuck on you. And I think it becomes easier to build that when you find someone who does have a secure attachment or is at least working towards that or has moved through their own stuff or at least is aware of what they're coming in the relationship with and can experience and share that with you. Right? Like I also had a very anxious attachment. And I still do sometimes, right? Like there's still remnants that come up and trigger me every now and then. But when I met my now husband back then, like he had a pretty secure attachment. And like that was probably the hardest relationship to start because I was like on guard. I was looking out like, oh, he's saying all these nice things. He must be lying or he might be trying to put the charm on me. I'm going to wait, right? All these things. I think that one is the toughest relationship after having so many bad experiences, the healthy one, because now we're expecting it. And the other person's like, no, I'm just here. I just really like you. I just really enjoy your company. There's nothing extra you have to do. You don't have to earn my love in any way, right? Like it has to be reciprocal, you know, in that way, but it's not games. And there's something that he said, and I really love this part just because for all those listeners who have trust issues based on their past experiences, is a lot of the times I would meet people on dates and they would try to convey like, I'm trustworthy to say that. Like, oh, you can trust me. We have all these future plans together before they really knew me. And in the beginning, that would be a hook, right? Like, oh my God, they like me because that's what I needed to hear. But then I started to be like, you don't know me well enough to tell me these things. So then I would be a little thrown off. And then when I met Iran, when I expressed some of these trust issues and fears, he said, can you just give me the opportunity to prove it to you? And I was like, I like that answer. That's a good answer. Okay. I'll give you the opportunity. You're not trying to tell me that I can trust you. You're not trying to put the charm on. You're just trying to, you just want an opportunity. And so I think kind of looking in the lens of how we were, so like, how do you feel around the person? Like, is it mixed messages or does it feel sincere? And giving it some time to see if the words and actions line up and are congruent to what's going on.
I think here, what you're describing too, is what is now termed as love bombing.
Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I just met you, but you are the most amazing, awesome person. We're going to get married and have all these kids and a life. And you're like, okay, like it's been one date, but all right. Mm-hmm. And then it doesn't, they don't show up in that way anymore. And so for whatever reason that is, you're right. Like allowing somebody and us ourselves as well of proving our loyalty and our trustworthiness to someone. It's a whole part of the process of dating.
You two have both shared so many valuable points. I keep thinking of so many people. I'm like, I'm going to have to send them this episode because we all need to hear this. And it's just, it's amazing to hear that there's ease with what you both say. I have to be honest, coming from this perspective of now, you know, newly going into dating world, and I'm definitely going to say that I have an anxious attachment style, but so going into it all, it brings me ease, and hopefully ease for other people hearing that, you know, therapists such as yourselves can help work through this with somebody to just get them back to what I'm hearing is their own needs, right? Their needs and being straightforward and as honest as possible and building the practice and the courage to express those needs and express any type of communication. And so, you know, take away all of these other things that I have also flooded Kier with before, you know, what if it's love bombing? Oh my gosh, I have to worry about STDs. Oh my, you know, all of these things, like so many things come up with dating. I really appreciate what you two both focused on with the attachment style, because it does feel like you can work to understand this to not actually make your mind go on overload with how much goes into now. Just simply finding out if you like the person's company. Like to me, that's the main thing. It's like you want to know your needs and first and foremost, do we have those in common? Do you understand that? You know, it's I'm blabbering a little bit now, but it does bring me a lot of ease.
I'm actually really glad that you brought up sexually transmitted infections. I think that is a huge taboo topic that people are so afraid to bring up. But when we're dating and we are sexually active with somebody, it is more than appropriate not only to ask them if they have been tested, but to tell them to get tested before being intimate with you. It's not worth going through the hassle of things when it could just be a very simple conversation, whether you guys go together or separate and send each other pictures of the negative test. And if it's positive, thank goodness we checked it out. But having those hard conversations too when you're dating to protect yourself, your body, your mind, that is more than appropriate as well.
Absolutely. And those are important, very important conversations in the beginning that can be super awkward depending on, you know, your level of comfort, the other person's level of comfort, how you just met, right? All of these different factors can make it feel uncomfortable. And I think it's also an opportunity to see how do each of you respond and react when there's a tough conversation. I think that's a great way as a stress test almost, like, how does this person react to a request or a need that I have to feel comfortable to continue pursuing this, right? That's a huge indicator if they are someone who's emotionally safe or perhaps not at this current time. And I think it's also important to recognize that if someone does have an STI, that doesn't mean they can't be sexually active or they can't be in relationships, right? Like, I think it's important to disclose certain information, but for other people to recognize, like, there's still other ways to go about this. So it's not about if you do have an STI that, like, this is done, right? For some people, that might be, you know, a hard line, and that's okay. We all have our boundaries. But for other people, it could be like, okay, like, let me do a little bit of research and like understanding about this. Like, maybe it's not as bad as I think or how I was taught however many years ago in our horrible sex ed in high school or middle school, right? Like, having these conversations about sex is going to be really, really important too. So that's a great feature that I'm glad that you brought up, actually, because it is something that people think about while they're dating. And so, Lior, I know you also work with couples. How does this show up in the room for you if there is something going on with intimacy, or do you work with couples around intimacy?
I do work with couples around intimacy, but if because I was not sexually trained, meaning I did not specialize in sex therapy. Wow, that was a weird way to put it, but all right.
we were all sexually trained differently. No.
Yes. So that, if you guys are wondering what we learn in school, we are sexually trained. No, I'm not a sex therapist. I headed more towards the family route, but so if it is something that feels out of my scope of expertise, I always refer out. But if it is more of communication around sex or sometimes mismatched intimacy or desire levels, that's something that I think is appropriate and honestly something that a lot of couples go through. I would say probably every single couple I've ever worked with, sex and intimacy has been a topic. No matter what. So how do I work with that? I mean, again, baseline, we start with, can you communicate? And then after that, can you communicate about sex? And then after that, what are your desire levels, right? It's not necessarily a drive of like, when I think of a drive, I think of like, I need this. Like, if I don't have this, I'm not going to survive in this world. Like, I have food drive, like I need food to survive. I have liquid drive, I need water to survive. But sex drive, I mean, the drive to have sex is going to look differently for everybody because it's not something that we need to sustain to live or is not going to sustain us living wise. So I think that is ultimately also some psychoeducation around intimacy and what it means and also what it looks like. Is it just penetrative sex or is it, you know, I like to say all of the bases, right? When we grew up, we learned about first, second, third, home run, right? So what does it look like to you? And especially with people with different sexual orientations and same sex couples or, you know, relationships, different types of relationships, right? It's going to look differently for everybody. So just understanding that just because your best friend had sex 6 times yesterday doesn't mean that that's the norm. It's just the norm for them.
So this has been amazing. We are coming towards the end. A quick question though that I want to ask you, Lior, is what is something that your clients might not know about you that you would love them to know so they can just, you know, get to know your personality some more, know your interests?
I think, you know, because I'm so open on social media, I very rarely like leave things out. I mean, of course, if it's going to be damaging to my clients, I don't talk about it 100%, but on social media, I'm very open on like my struggles and like what I go through. But I think something I've noticed is that people have a very different perspective of who I am versus actually who I am. And it makes me think of, I don't know if you guys are on like TikTok or Reels on Instagram, but of that like sound that's like, never know your, like, never let them know your next move or like something like that. And I feel like that's me of like, I wear so many different hats, like, but that's authentically to who I am. Like, I still align with my morals and values, but like, I was the kind of kid that, like, I never got a detention, but I was 100% rebellious. And, like, I did, like, not bad things, but I wasn't, like, sitting at home studying and, like, such a goody-goody. But this perception of, like, therapists need to be this, like, perfect, like, I know how to act and, like, I'm so amazing in my self-care. Like, hell no. I just, like everybody else, make mistakes, react rather than respond. And I think that that just, I like to say that to remind everybody that we're all in this together. Like, we're, oh my gosh, now I'm thinking of High School Musical. We're all in this together. Because we are. Troy Bolton had a girl. Yeah. Sherpay. They had a great point there, because we really are. Nobody is better than anybody else. We're just all trying to figure it all out. So yeah, I feel like that's it about me, is I'm imperfectly imperfect. I don't know.
I think it's beautiful. It's, I have to tell you, when I talk a lot with people about, you know, encouraging them to continue with any type of professional help. And I do find myself at times, I feel a bit bad, because I feel therapists, you all do get a lot of pressure put on you. And I find myself, I try to have your back. I felt, you know, like, yeah, okay, well, you know, they might have just been having a bad day. They are human, you know, like, you know, cut them some slack. So I'm glad that you shared that with everyone, of like that realness. So thank you for sharing that realness about, you know, there's times that, you know, you both are human, although you both, I'm assuming, do amazing work, although I'm not one of your clients, you know, but you're still, you have that, there's those imperfections, and you're working through it with us too.
That's right.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, Lior, thank you so much for being on today. I didn't even realize the time went by, because I feel like we could have just kept talking about a million other things. I did want to mention real quick about you, because I know that you just expanded to another state, another physical location. So if you want to share with the listeners how they can reach you and where you're providing your incredible services at.
Yeah, absolutely. So we offer therapy in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. We have a physical location in Devon, Pennsylvania, which is on the main line, if anybody is familiar with that. And if you are looking for me, just type in thetherapygal.com. Gal, because my last name's Gal, so that is the thought behind the name. And I'm also on social media, both on TikTok and Instagram, as The Therapy Gal. And you can fill out a contact form or give us a call, and we will help match you with the best fit therapist.
This is a Bivesta production.